Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It's been a fairly quiet summer on the road for many New Jerseyans. There are fewer traffic cones, construction crews, and bottlenecks in sight. Makes for easier driving, perhaps, but observers say there will be a price to pay. Most projects meant to repair roads, bridges, and rails are on hold because the state's Transportation Trust Fund is just about out of money. Those who labor on these projects are out of work during the prime summer construction season and are watching finances dwindle. And the longer the situation continues, the harder this will hit the taxpayer as starting and restarting projects becomes more expensive. At the heart of this is gridlock involving the legislature and the governor. If the gas tax is raised 23 cents, should other taxes be lowered or phased out entirely, and which taxes? What do you think? Is this affecting you? 888-477-9499 is the number, or you could send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. To begin, we are joined by New Jersey State Senate President Stephen Sweeney. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Mary.
Sure. So raising the gas tax 23 cents to fund the trust fund, this is a given here. It's just about inevitable.
Well, we need to fund it. We need to fund it in a proper way so that we can really make an investment in our transportation system. You know, New York has made a major investment. Connecticut has. Pennsylvania has. New Jersey's a logistics state. And without funding our transportation trust fund, you know, it really does enormous damage to the economy of the state. And, Mary, back in 2003, they were talking about 6 cents. And the argument back then was it's too much money. And, you know, we all recognize that times are tough, but without making investments in transportation, you're pretty much committing your economy to, you know, taking a back seat. So we have to find a way to fix it. And, you know, we're talking 23 cents now because we didn't fix it back then. So every year that it goes beyond, it costs more. In fact, some people so we'll just borrow for 2 years until Christie leaves. Well, if you do that, it gets up to 30 cents.
Yeah.
And what we're trying to do is get our economy back moving and really fix our highways and roads. And part of it also is, you know, we want to double the money we give to towns and counties. They used to be 20% of the Transportation Trust Fund. They're now 11% of the funding. And by increasing funding to towns and counties, you're actually reducing the burden on the property taxpayer, because that's how they fund their roads, by property taxes.
So let's get back to Governor Christie for a moment. He has said he'll agree to the 23 cents, but he wants the sales tax dropped by a penny. You were initially fine with this, but then had second thoughts about that.
I originally agreed to it based on numbers I was shown. And within an hour of seeing the real numbers, we made it very clear we weren't in agreement, and that's why we were so surprised that they went forward with it, because the numbers were off by $600 million. Mm-hmm. You know, we the Speaker and I, had originally agreed to $900 million roughly in tax cuts. The governor's brought it up to $1.6 or $1.8 billion, and we just can't afford that. Mary, it's not doable.
So, Steve Sweeney, what does the latest plan on your end look like?
Not much different than what's sitting out there right now, Mary. We went back to the Speaker, and he agreed to basically do the same bill with minor changes than we originally proposed. I'm at 26 votes. I need 27 for an override, and we're at 26 solid, so we're just mining for that one other vote. You know, as things go on, and I don't want to be right on this. I said I don't expect this to get done. And, you know, until after the presidential election, because we're getting into the political season.
So in the meantime, if this waits till after the presidential election, you know, as we're talking about here, there are a lot of men and women off the job trying to manage family budgets. You know, this is the busiest season of the year for construction. What do you tell them?
Mary, no one understands it more than me. I'm a union ironworker.
Sure.
And my members are being laid off because of this. But what I have to tell them is I can't destroy the economic future of the state. You know, and that's what the governor was looking for. We can't do it. You know, we were willing to, I can't believe we were actually willing to talk about $900 million in tax cuts when we have all these bills that we're trying to pay, and, you know, New Jersey's economy isn't flush with cash to start with. But we were really doing it because we felt like the tax cuts we were targeting are income retention, and we were going to be able to keep more people in New Jersey that you know, that don't have kids in schools, and we really want to stay here. But we just couldn't make the tax cuts that the governor wants and make the pension payment. And, you know, I'm still committed to finding a way to fund the pension. But most importantly is being responsible to fix our infrastructure in a way that is the most responsible way possible. We have a constitutional amendment to on the ballot this year that any money has to only go to highways. It can't be diverted. It can't go to run the department. So we're doing everything we can to instill trust in the public what would happen with the money. But, you know, we have a lot of innocent people being harmed here. You know, the laborers, the operating engineers, the iron workers, the carpenters, the cement finishers, the people do all the construction. And this is prime season for them.
So Steve Sweeney, as an iron worker yourself, are you hearing from them and what are you telling them?
I do hear from them. I hear from them every day. What I'm telling them is we're trying to fix it. We're trying to fix it. No one understands it more than I do because, you know, my members are directly impacted. But that being said, I also have a responsibility to the taxpayers and the residents and the citizens of the state of New Jersey. And I am not going to do something so irresponsible that it's going to destroy the, you know, the ability to do anything in the next administration.
So,
and, you know, regardless of who the governor is.
Let's get to the taxpayer. It's estimated that it could cost 25% more to start these projects behind schedule. Are you hearing from taxpayers about this?
Honestly, we're not hearing from taxpayers. We're really hearing from the people that have been impacted because the taxpayers haven't felt it yet, Mary. The taxpayers haven't felt it yet. There is a cost to shut down a project and to remobilize a project, to start one back up again. And, you know, people don't see that. You know, governments see it. Governments recognize it. But no one's going to say Road A just cost another $1 million because they started it up and shut it down. You know what I'm saying? It'll get done. It's just the cost will be increased. And unfortunately, it's obviously a very bad outcome.
Have you and Governor Christie been talking lately about this?
I am supposed to meet with him this week. Hopefully, we will be meeting this week. You know, he actually announced that we were going to meet, and I look forward to talking to him again. You know, we were willing to compromise, and we think we compromised a great deal putting $900 million in tax cuts on the table. Him wanting twice as much is not acceptable, and we really can't move much beyond where we're at and really be able to fund schools and do other things going forward.
So it doesn't sound as if you're hopeful that you're going to have resolution with this next meeting.
I'm not. Mm-hmm. Mary, I'm unfortunately, I really am not. And for all the people that are being impacted, you know, all the companies, all the construction companies and the secretaries and others, you know, people just look at the construction guys. There's a lot of people that are impacted beyond just the construction people. You know, you have the asphalt plants that are laying people off because they should be busy now and they're not. So, you know, my concerns, my heart goes out to them because I know what it's like to be unemployed. I was a union iron worker. I collected unemployment.
So if you,
it's the
if
worst
you're,
feeling in the world.
If you're able to put that veto-proof majority together, and I think you said you have one more person you have to get bring over to your side, does this move forward? And when does the legislature next meet?
We meet on the 15th for a voting session. And if I can gather that 27th vote by then, yes, we'll put it up for a vote.
And at this point, your sense is this would jive with anything that would happen in the assembly and you could get this moved forward?
Well, then the assembly has to work to get their votes.
Yeah.
You know, this has not been an easy process. It's been a very difficult process to get people to support it because, look, you're getting a lot of people saying we don't want our gas tax to go up. And I get that. No one does. But I also know that when they shut down bridges and your commutes wind up 20 minutes longer, you know, when a 3-minute commute winds up 20 minutes because you have to go all the way around to get there, People don't like that either.
And a couple more quick questions, because I know we told you we'd only keep you a few minutes, Steve Sweeney. Urgent repairs are being taken care of, correct? I mean, there's a lot of many projects on hold, but the bridge that is crumbling, the stretch of highway that might be dangerous, that is being taken care of?
Yeah, they're doing emergency repairs. And but again, understanding how this works, you know, I've had guys, iron workers, working on beams where there were cracks, and there was a crack in a beam two beams away, and they weren't fixing that one. So they're doing just enough to get by, you know, God forbid, anything bad happens. But I think that they've taken enough precautions to keep things going. And the department, the DOT, has shut down bridges when they felt they were not safe. You know, they've been shutting bridges down. And that's where you're seeing people really being angry, because now a short ride to the corner store becomes a long one.
Mm-hmm. And if you had to, in a word or two, just characterize the state of infrastructure in New Jersey, what would that word be?
It's poor. And
overall.
And for us, overall, and again, New Jersey is a logistics state. We're in the middle of 60 million people. It is. We need to move people and product. What you see in Pennsylvania right now is a major investment that was being done in infrastructure. You see it in New York. And New York's talking about a $100 billion plan. Connecticut's talking a $100 billion plan. And New Jersey, we were talking about 20. And with a federal match of 20, which would be 40. But we need to make this investment. And where it hurts the economy is no business is going to come here if they don't see a long-range plan to maintain and improve our transportation system.
All right. We have about a minute left or so, so I'd like to get a quick comment in from Franco, who says, the state is the highest tax state. The last thing we need is more taxes, especially when the state plans on cutting state aid to lower-performing school districts, ergo raising the taxes on low-income residents. A quick response to that.
Well, we're not going to cut funding to schools. That's the governor's plan. It's not one that works. And the other one is, listen, I get it. I absolutely get it. But how do you pay for the roads? How do you pay for the roads and bridges? They don't come free. Municipal roads, municipal bridges, county roads, county bridges are paid for by property taxes. You know, when someone drives on 295 in South Jersey, it's not a toll road, but it's not a free road. It's paid for with a gas tax.
And Steve Sweeney, I just want to get him one more quick question before we have to get up against this break here. You know, completely different issue. Your name keeps coming up when there's talk about candidates for governor for 2017, and we'll always take a scoop here at Radio Times.
Well, there's no scoop to be had today.
Okay.
You know, I'm considering it like a lot of other people are right now, but it's early.
All right. Worth a try. Steve Sweeney, thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.
Thank you.
Stephen Sweeney is president of the New Jersey State Senate. And in just a moment, Michael Simons will join the conversation. He covers the State House for New Jersey 101.5. And we'll continue our conversation for a couple more moments on the Transportation Trust Fund. 888-477-9499 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. There is more in just a moment. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Infrastructure is our focus this hour. The bridges, roads, and rails many of us use daily, and if you're like me, don't give a second thought to. Maintenance is, of course, crucial. Funding is a challenge, and we're going to spend a few more moments looking at the stalemate over New Jersey's Transportation Trust Fund and the fact that a lot of construction work has ground to a halt this summer. Michael Simons covers the State House for New Jersey 101.5. Welcome to Radio Times, Michael.
Hi, Mary. Good to be with you.
Sure. And also, let me just get that number out one more time. 888-477-9499. RadioTimes@whyy.org is the email, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So I'm sure you were listening into the conversation we had just a few moments ago with Steve Sweeney. When do you see this situation being resolved, Michael, and how?
I'm surprised it hasn't been resolved yet, honestly. I didn't imagine that it would go this long, and I don't think any of the folks who work in the construction industry who've now been idled for 7 weeks or so thought it would go this long. So you know, the Senate president says could go until November, and you know, he's in the building today. The governor's in the building today here in the State House, so perhaps they'll meet today. I mean, it's going to involve, it's going to require them to all get into the room together and try to hash something out. I mean, the problem in June wasn't really getting the votes in the Senate. The problem was that they didn't have the support in the Assembly. So when the Senate president talks about being one vote away from getting his veto-proof majority in the Senate, that's kind of where they were in June, trying to get to that point, but they were more than just one or two votes away in the Assembly.
Yeah. Let's get into the situation a little bit more regarding the taxes. It seems as if that 23-cent a gallon tax for gas, the additional 23 cents, is inevitable. But the question is, what is cut? There's the sales tax. There are also estate taxes that are also on the table. Could you just describe that? Give us a briefing, if you would.
Sure. Yeah, both sides basically have concurred that a 23-cent a gallon increase in the gas tax is what they would be willing to support. So if you're a person who drives 15,000 miles a year, your car gets 25 miles a gallon, that's going to add about $140 to an additional gas tax over the course of a year. And that's just for one person. So if it's a two-car family, you're talking about $280. Maybe your car doesn't get that much per gallon. So it's definitely an increase in taxes on the average person. So the governor has been saying for a while, I will go along with something like that. I will consider something like that if it involves what he has dubbed tax fairness. And that was always a phrase that didn't really define exactly what that meant. And lawmakers worked on a package that included phasing out the estate tax, increasing the earned income tax credit, providing an income tax deduction for things like charitable contributions. And they put together a package hoping that that would both get the governor's support and find enough support in the legislature. And ultimately, the governor didn't think that was that qualified as tax fairness, because the estate tax helped the wealthy, the earned income tax credit helped low-income families, but there was a big hole in the middle where middle-income families weren't really receiving anything from that. So he struck a last-second alternative deal with the Assembly revolved around the sales tax.
Sure.
And that would affect everybody, but it would be more money from the state budget. It also wouldn't quite provide as much benefit as the governor says, but certainly that is something that applies to everybody. Everybody pays the sales tax.
Yeah, but Steve Sweeney says it would leave a big hole in next year's budget.
Right. Yeah, it would definitely reduce state revenues more than what the Senate is willing to go along with. Mm-hmm. And the Senate and some people in the Assembly who are working on the legislature's version of the package wanted to try to use it as sort of a way to reset some of New Jersey's tax structure. And I think the Senate president was talking about, like, maybe if the estate tax is reduced, then people don't leave the state, wealthy families don't leave the state after retirement. They would also, under both plans, the governor's plan and the legislature's, increase the amount of retirement income that would be exempt from taxes, again, to try to encourage older residents not to leave upon retirement. So there was a certain strategy that they had involved, and they, even though that wasn't necessarily fair and that it wasn't going to affect everybody, they were hoping that it would have an economic impact beyond sales tax. I don't, you know, do people move out of New Jersey because the sales tax is 7% as opposed to 6%?
Yeah. Let's get to some calls, if you don't mind. We've got Paolo from Delaware County calling into Radio Times. So welcome to Radio Times, Paolo.
Hi. Hello. Basically, hold on one second. I want to get off the speakerphone.
Okay.
Basically, I'm a transportation consultant, but I have to get into the weeds a little bit. The basis for the transportation tax is basically the gas tax, which basically falls on the drivers. The beneficiaries of the transportation system are virtually every site in the region, all the office buildings, factories. Mm-hmm. None of them could exist without the transportation system, yet those guys pay zero for it, zero, literally zero. So the bottom line is, to get tax equity, you need a different funding basis. And the funding basis that I'm suggesting is one that's been in use by the transportation profession for the last 50 years, as long as I've been in the profession.
So, Paolo, we only have a moment or two left with Michael Simons.
I'm going to finish. It's
sure.
Basically this. You got to get to the site. So every site that has to pay a tax based on its use in the transportation modeling field, it's called a trip generation rate. And you can make that rate comparable to what the drivers pay in taxes for gas, and that can be applied to every site. That will triple the amount of money that comes now from the gas tax. That will finance it in an equitable way because everybody that's using the transportation system will actually pay for it.
Yeah. Paolo, that's thank you so much for your call to Radio Times. You just have to move along a little more quickly because we don't have you too much longer, Michael Simons. I don't know if this is in your wheelhouse, but what do you think of what Paolo said?
It's an interesting concept. I haven't heard it discussed, and that doesn't mean that there aren't necessarily talks going on about it. I don't know of any state that does it that way. He made it sound as if it is something that is done in certain places, but I'm not entirely familiar with the concept.
But again, increasing the gas tax will hit some harder than others.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's a commuter-reliant state, so it would hit a lot of people. I mean, a lot of people do use mass transit also, and some of the benefits from the money would go toward mass transit. But while the gas tax in New Jersey has not increased since 1988, certainly transit fares have frequently.
Michael Simon, up north, Union and Hudson counties are said to be ready to sue. As an observer, do you think they have a legal leg to stand on?
They could, yeah. I mean, certainly counties and municipalities are going to incur additional costs. There are costs associated with shutting a project down and then costs associated with starting it back up. You know, all the big heavy equipment that the construction companies had there, they aren't going to just leave idle on the side of the road for an indeterminate amount of time. So there are, I don't know that there's a flat rate that you can apply to every project, but there are going to be costs associated with each. And then there's the delay cost. You know, schools are getting ready to start back up. A lot of towns work on their construction project near a school during the summer so that it doesn't impact drop-offs and all the rest of that stuff. And they lost all that time at this point. If towns wanted to do projects near schools, they've got that logistics to work through eventually.
Michael Simon, in doing research for this show, I found a quote from one construction worker, Rick Pullen of Bayville, who says, "Concrete is not permanent. I've been working on bridges for most of my career. If people got a chance to look beneath them, they wouldn't want to drive on top of them." So it's safe to say this is a back burner issue for the average New Jerseyan, and it shouldn't be?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, people are very aware of what they pay in gas taxes. So to a lot of people, that's their initial reaction to the entire debate is, you know, why are you increasing my gas taxes? The one nice thing we have in New Jersey is the low gas tax. But certainly, and even the State Department of Transportation will occasionally put little videos on YouTube of some of the damage that they've seen underneath, you know, small bridges and things like that. And you look at that, you're like, oh my gosh, you know, heavy cars and trucks are driving along that road. So, it's, you know, the infrastructure needs work, not just the roads infrastructure, other things too, such as water delivery systems. But I don't think people necessarily think about all that stuff often until it's kind of too late.
All right. Well, Michael Simons, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us at Radio Times.
Thanks. Take care.
Michael Simons covers the State House for New Jersey 101.5. Well, New Jersey, of course, isn't the only state challenged by crumbling infrastructure. The American Society of Civil Engineers estimates that as a whole, the United States will need to make an investment of over $3.5 trillion by 2020 to bring roads, bridges, water systems, electrical grids, and et cetera, up to par. So how are the presidential candidates responding? Joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., Robert Puentes is the president of the Transportation Policy Group, Enotrans. Welcome to Radio Times, Robert.
Thank you, Mary, for having me.
And Nick Timmeros covers economics and the presidential race for the Wall Street Journal. Nice to have you with us, Nick.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
So, actually, it's Mary for this hour, but I can see the mistake is easy to make, isn't it? So, you know, let's start off with this question. In a word, if you had to describe the state of infrastructure in this country, if you were to characterize it, how would you do so, Nick?
Well, it's something that the federal government has been doing. It's somewhat in fits and starts. I mean, as you guys were just discussing, because the gas tax hasn't gone up since the early 90s and because fuel efficiency has improved, the funding stream just isn't what it used to be. So if you were to compare what we spent in 2014 to what we spent in 1960 and you use inflation-adjusted dollars, the U.S. spent about twice as much in raw dollars. But if you calculate it as a share of GDP, it's actually gone down. So the U.S., the federal government, is spending less on highways now than it was 50 years ago. And then if you go and look at state and local spending as a share of GDP, it's also at a 30-year low. One of the big challenges right now has been that it's been hard for lawmakers to come up with a new funding stream, given the lack of really political willingness to raise the gas tax.
Yeah. So is infrastructure just not a sexy issue to many Americans? Is that the problem?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the interesting thing right now is that you're hearing in the presidential campaign both candidates, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, saying that they want to do infrastructure. So Hillary Clinton has made upgrading the nation's roads and bridges and energy and water systems a central part of her pitch. I mean, her economic plan is kind of centered around, we're going to spend $275 billion in 5 years on infrastructure. And keep in mind that Congress just last December approved a five-year highway and transit spending bill of $305 billion. So she would pretty much add almost double what has already been allocated for infrastructure. Donald Trump has come out. He hasn't really put forward a specific proposal, but he said in an interview a few weeks ago, well, what Hillary Clinton's proposing isn't enough. I would do twice that. Mm. So that is actually different. The challenge, of course, even though everybody can agree that, you know, we want to have less traffic, right, and we want to have better quality infrastructure and airports,
sure.
Paying for it is where we really just kind of come apart.
Mm-hmm. We're going to parse the candidates' proposals extensively, hopefully, here over the next a few moments of Radio Times. But Robert Puentes, I want to ask you this question. If you had to characterize the state of America's infrastructure in a word or two, what would you call it?
I think it is challenged right now. I mean, we know that there is a lot of infrastructure that is in a state of disrepair. You talked about the American Society of Civil Engineers and the studies that they've added up, looking at just what needs to be reinvested in the existing system because it just needs to be fixed. Like your house needs to be fixed, so does our infrastructure. But there's also a lot of infrastructure that is just outdated and outmoded and probably geared more towards the last century than the new technology-driven high-tech, infrastructure the economy that we're looking at right now. So massive upgrades and massive investments in technology could go throughout the system. And then there's new investments that we need to make. You know, we're still a growing country, particularly out in the West and the Intermountain West. There's a lot of people moving to these places, and there's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be invested in those places as well. But in all these cases, I think we tend to both use this term infrastructure too abstractly. We talked so far on the show mostly about roads and transportation infrastructure.
How would you break it out?
Well, there's electricity in the electric grid. There's energy. There's water. Then you can talk about schools and hospitals. So when we think about these big public investments, you start to get into lots and lots of different areas. It's easier to bucket it out when you just think about things like transportation and water, which are two areas of infrastructure. I think most folks think, there needs to be a large public investment. But then when we look even at those, when you look about what the federal government should be doing, even there, it's actually relatively small. Only about 30% of the money is coming from the federal government. So because we use this big abstract term infrastructure, we think it's this enormous problem that only the federal government can fix. But as you're trying to do here, Mayor, I think it's right to parse it out. Really, where are the triggers? Who's investing in what? Yeah. Who's responsible for what? Yeah. And then how can we do those investments we need to get done here in the 21st century economy?
Okay, so the figure that's been put forth by the American Society of Civil Engineers, the estimate that, to have all this happen by the year 2020 or thereabouts is $3.5 trillion. Are we talking about a pipe dream here, Nick Timrose?
Well, I mean, $3.5 trillion is not going to happen, right? That may be kind of ask for your wish list, But if you look at the dollars that, at least at the federal level, are being talked about, I mean, it's definitely under a trillion. It's under half a trillion, probably. So I don't know if pipe dream is fair or unfair, but you know, we have to pay for these things, or you have to borrow more money if you're not going to pay for it. And there is probably more appetite to take on debt. If you go back a few years ago, I mean, after the stimulus bill passed in 2009, there was the Tea Party movement, right? And a lot of that was concern over the national debt rising. How are we going to make our grandchildren pay for this? If you look at what's happened since then, for the country, our borrowing costs have gone down. So even though the national debt in raw numbers has gone up almost double, the cost to service that debt has gone down because interest rates have been so low. And as more economists say, well, maybe, you know, there was a view a few years ago that interest rates would normalize, they would go back up, where they had been before the financial crisis. As this view takes hold that maybe we're entering a lower growth world, where there's going to be more demand for American assets, for American bonds, maybe we should take advantage of these lower borrowing costs, lock in lower rates, and finance this investment. Even then, though, I think if we're going to do that, the $3 trillion, unless you're able to come up with some sort of private financing, an infrastructure bank, I just don't see the government spending that kind of money on this right now.
And Robert Puentes, we've got about 30 seconds before we have to go to the break. Would you like to weigh in on this?
I think it's exactly right. I think we need to be looking at lots of different investment vehicles. I think this idea for the infrastructure bank has been talked about for a number of years here in this country. I think that there's a proposal for how we're going to get that capitalized now. That's something the federal government should be doing. But in the meantime, we have cities, states, metropolitan areas, and the private sector all picking up the slack, recognizing there is no cavalry coming from Washington right now, and they're doing the hard work that they need to do, raising their own taxes, going to the voters, and investing in innovative programs. It's a really interesting time in infrastructure now.
Yes, we are talking infrastructure on Radio Times. Robert Puentes is with the Transportation Policy Group, Enotrans. Nick Timrose covers economics and the presidential race for the Wall Street Journal. If you'd like to jump in, 888-477-9499. Keep it here for more of Radio Times. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. For this part of the hour, we're examining the way our nation's infrastructure is funded, what the presidential candidates think, and we are joined by Robert Puentes with the Transportation Policy Group, Enotrans, and Nick Timrose covers economics and the presidential race for the Wall Street Journal. As always, our numbers, 888-477-9499. We do have some lines open. If you'd like to send us a comment, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So going into the break, we did touch on the concept of a national infrastructure bank, which is part of Hillary Clinton's proposal. Clinton's not the first to propose an infrastructure bank. Senators Chris Dodd and Chuck Hagel, Democrat and Republican respectively, did this about 10 years ago. It didn't fly. Do you see something like this getting by any future Congress in the near future, Republican or Democrat, Robert Puentes?
It's tough to predict anything that's going on politically here in Washington. It's a strange time.
Is there more of an openness to the concept?
There is probably more of an openness now than there has been before. But putting aside all the crazy politics and everything else for now. But the primary barrier, I think, to a national infrastructure bank, which is this targeted mechanism for financing infrastructure projects of truly national significance, is finding a way to build the loan fund. There are these untaxed corporate profits that are overseas, which currently provide little support to overstretched federal budgets. So the idea is to try to tap that revenue source to quickly fund an infrastructure bank. And I think if you made the case that we're going to go through this scheme, and that money would only go for those projects that truly met measures of some kind of benefit cost ratio, some kind of clear economic benefit to the country, that is a message that I think business leadership and elected leadership can get behind, because we're making those investments, not spreading it around the country very thinly like peanut butter or funding bridges to nowhere, but these are the investments that meet these clear criteria of measures for impact. That's something I think we can get behind.
Nick Timiraos, what do you think?
I think it's easier to conclude that something's going to happen here on infrastructure. It's harder to say whether it's going to be an infrastructure bank or whether it's just going to be a pool of funds or whether it's going to be some kind of special bond program like a Build America bond. So I would say there's a the odds that something happens on infrastructure, I'd say are at least 50-50, something happening in the next couple of years, again, because both parties have said that's something they would want to do. Whether it's an infrastructure bank or some other mechanism, I think is a little bit harder to say.
A separate capital budget for the federal government. John Cassidy writes in The New Yorker that the resurrection of an old idea with its own financing arrangements might be an answer. The UK apparently did this under Tony Blair. Robert, what do you think?
That's also been talked about probably for a generation here in the U.S. It kind of doesn't get you to some of the reasons that you would do an infrastructure bank in terms of making sure that we're focusing on the lifecycle costs of these projects and that we're not just doing investments now, but we're looking at it over time. It gets you some of the way there. I think it's it's much more cumbersome to try to reorient the federal budget right now. As hard as an infrastructure bank is going to be, that's even a level of complexity even more. So, yeah, you can do that, but it's again, I think it's very challenging to do right now.
Yeah, and as far as the UK is concerned, worth mentioning, it worked to a point until the economy slumped there, apparently.
Indeed.
So all right, let's get to Donald Trump. Again, it was mentioned before the break that he would double Hillary Clinton's proposal to fund infrastructure. This seems to be a progressive tack on Trump's part, doesn't it, Nick? Nick Timiraos?
Yeah, it's interesting because Donald Trump has, on several issues, said things that sometimes go to the left of the Democratic nominee. And I think this is one of those cases. What's challenging about it is that he hasn't put out a lot of specifics on it. So this was an interview at the beginning of August he did on TV where he said, it should be twice what Hillary's doing. And he was pressed on specifics, and he said, well, we'll go out with a fund. We'll make a great deal with the low interest rates we have right now. We really have to rebuild our infrastructure. So he hasn't said in specifics, how much we're going to do, how we're going to raise the money, but he's at least kind of put out this idea or this aspiration, and it's something he's written about in his book. He talks about on the campaign stump from time to time. So that's out there. And you also have other Republicans. I mean, it's not just Donald Trump. You have other Republicans saying we need to do more on infrastructure. The question, I think, is going to be, again, what kind of projects and how do you pay for them?
Yeah. What's realistic?
And that's where it gets hard.
So, and Robert, guessing Trump is giving many conservatives agita with this. Some say this sounds like President Obama's 2009 stimulus plan.
Well, again, there's not a whole lot of specifics here, as we just talked about. It is different from 2008 in a lot of different reasons. I mean, we're not anywhere near the economic conditions we were in back then. The stimulus package kind of came in because there was this clear national understanding that we had to do something to staunch the bleeding. We were losing 600,000 jobs a month. Unemployment was, 8.1, 8.2% or something. So, I mean, there was clearly a national galvanizing moment here. It's really not the same right now. And even though infrastructure did get to be a big piece of the stimulus package, excluding the tax cuts. It was about a fourth, about a quarter of the stimulus package. But there was this big emphasis on shovel-ready projects. We had to get money out the door very quickly because we had to put people to work. We had to stop the bleeding. And it went to then things that were shovel-ready, kind of the pothole refillings, the things that we needed to do.
Yeah.
But it really didn't match, I think, people's expectations that we were going to use this money and have, super high-tech investments all across the country. So we'd have to temper expectations this time around. There's not the urgency, clearly, like it was before to fix the economy, but there is the same kind of urgency to make targeted investments in different areas of infrastructure.
Let's look at the roads and bridges piece of infrastructure. What about the argument put forth by groups which tend toward the right that those who use roads and bridges should pay for them with tolls? And obviously there are toll roads across the country, but I'm guessing they're saying, well, let's do more of that. Nick Timiraos, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, the Congressional Budget Office, which is kind of a nonpartisan shop for analysis, put out a report on this recently where they said, you know, there are the two challenges we have right now. One is that, you know, the gas tax doesn't provide as much oomph as it used to. The other is that just your dollar buys you less, right? With all of the increases in commodity prices over the last 20 years, your dollar doesn't get you as much. So what can you do about that? And, you know, what they come back to is having the government charge drivers directly for their use of the roads more often, that you have either congestion pricing or you kind of can limit supply and demand. And when there's demand for roads, you can charge people more. Obviously, that's going to have, maybe less popular because people don't want to pay when they use the roads. The CBO also said you can allocate funds to states on the basis of whether there's a cost benefit to what they're spending money on. So you can link spending more closely to performance measures such as traffic congestion or road quality, and the states that do a better job to meet standards are going to be first in line to get those funds.
Robert Puentes, both candidates say their proposals would create jobs. And according to Politico, the construction industry has rebounded. Unemployment's low, wages have started to rise, and a huge investment in infrastructure could produce a labor shortage. Do you see it that way?
I'm not sure. I mean, right now, infrastructure jobs is a huge share of the American workforce, about 11% of the civilian workforce in the U.S. is directly related to infrastructure. So not the guy cutting the hair or the guy who's filling the pothole, but the people who are actually working in the infrastructure space. But most of those jobs are actually in operations and maintenance. So it's, you know, we think about these guys with the hard hats on the side of the road, that these are the infrastructure jobs that are being funded by this. But it's really a huge mix of things. It's truck drivers. It's bus drivers. It's electrical technicians. The infrastructure jobs get well beyond just the short-term construction stuff. And given where we are right now in this country, given the massive need to make sure the system is operating at its peak efficiency and that we're repairing the system that needs to be repaired, we think about infrastructure jobs. We should be thinking not just about the construction stuff, but how the system's operated, maintained, and just organized every single day.
Let's get back to Politico for just a second. Danny Venick of Politico says many economists are nervous that the next president could have to deal with a recession, and that passing a large infrastructure bill in the next year or so could actually act as insurance against an economic downturn. Nick Timiraos, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, well, I mean, what you're hearing in that article, you hear kind of two opposite points, right? The first is that, well, do we really want to do federal stimulus right now if you think the economy is nearing full, what economists call full employment, right? The unemployment rate is below 5%. Is that necessarily the right strategy? The flip side of that is, well, as a kind of a counter-cyclical response to a recession, you would want to have these kinds of projects ready to go. So there are two different arguments there. I think it's a valid point that you want to think about what are the, what kind of ammunition do you have if you go into recession? I think one of the things we learned from the stimulus bill was that if you provide funds to states for highways, but then they are allowed to just cut their highway budgets because they're looking to have to plug budget holes somewhere, then it's better than nothing, but you're not really actually providing that much in terms of net new highway funding. I think you also think about what kinds of projects are you spending on in a recession versus just, you know, you want to build a bridge. That may take more time. That may not put as many people to work right away. But if you need that bridge, you need that bridge.
And, of course, Robert, the question is always, is there an appetite in Congress for something like this?
Again, not going to predict what's going to happen in Congress, but I mean, as we've talked about, it's not only bipartisan; it's nonpartisan. I mean, there's no Republican bridges, there's no Democrat roads, and so there's a clear need that all across the board to invest in infrastructure. And we see this when we leave Washington. I mean, this conversation is so focused on, broadly is focused on federal Washington, but we see states starting to do things like raise their own gasoline taxes. And in 2015, there were eight states, from their blue states, red states, and everything in between. Georgia, Idaho, Nebraska, Utah, Washington, all these states raised their own gasoline taxes, recognizing that this crosses partisan lines, that there's investments that need to be made. There are trust funds that need to be shored up. You talk to the folks about the New Jersey Trust Fund, for example. So this is a conversation that's happening all across the country, but it's a very different conversation outside the Washington Beltway than it is in state capitals across the country.
Speaking of the Jersey piece of the conversation, let's get to a comment from Joseph. He says, I've sent so many letters to everyone who represents me about the deplorable state of infrastructure in New Jersey, and in particular, our public transportation network. A properly funded public transportation network would take cars off the road, reduce pollution, and save people time in getting to and from work. It's nothing more than indicative of the unhealthy obsession with cars, and especially of the hypocrisy of conservatives who supposedly want people to pay for what they use while themselves not fully paying for their roads. And that is how we live. There's a lot of frustration there. And Nick, could you address that, please?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these things are expensive, right? I mean, if you look in Washington, D.C., for example, the subway system here has been, there's been a lot of deferred maintenance. There's now a lot of repair work going on. It's slowing down the whole system. It's leading to delays. So people want to have these things working. But we have to come up with the money to pay for them. And part of that isn't just the money to build them, but the money to keep them running and doing the kind of boring maintenance work that needs to get done. And when that doesn't happen, you end up frustrating riders and people who end up having to drive in because they don't like having to wait in lines anymore.
Continuing with our comments, we have a tweet from B. Sting. Shareholders benefit from increasing tolls, not the infrastructure. And Robert Puentes, what do you think of that?
I'm not sure if that's right. I mean, there is this push now for some private investment in new toll roads, really, in parts of the country. That's starting to wane a little bit more. The enthusiasm for private toll roads is a bit stagnant or declining. You do have things like here in on the Washington Beltway, where a private company came in, added lanes to the Beltway. They tolled those lanes, leaving the rest of it untolled. And then this new private company is getting the toll revenue that comes in as a revenue source for them, but also taking a lot of the risk. So if traffic is down, they're not going to make as much money. So I think that it's I don't see, especially in the Northeast Corridor and in probably where your listeners are, that this is not money that's going for into private hands, but the money is really being reinvested back into the existing system.
All right, just going to take a quick left turn before we wrap the show off, Pierre. We talked a little bit about the workforce involved in maintaining and building infrastructure. The benefits can be good. The negatives, though, still relatively few women and African Americans represented, though this is not the case for Latinos. Do you know of efforts and incentives to recruit more women and people of color into these fields? Nick Timrose?
You know, that's a good question, and it's just not something that I've heard a whole lot of discussion about, so I'm not quite sure what's being done there. Some of these industries, not just construction but in manufacturing, heavy manufacturing, they can tend to be, you saw someone's dad go into that work, and so the son go into it. I'm not sure what's being done to change that, but that's a very thoughtful question.
All right. On that note, go ahead, Robert.
The administration has had this whole ladders of opportunity effort over the last couple of years. They've been focused on the infrastructure jobs that go particularly for low income or low skilled workers. There are groups like the Women in Transportation Seminar. There's COMTO, the Center for Minority Officials in Transportation. So there's a lot of these efforts that are going on right now at the Eno Center for Transportation. We're also going to be looking at this,
Robert.
I think this is an enormous area.
Thank you so much for that info. On that note, we do have to say goodbye, Robert. Robert Puentes is with the Transportation Policy Group, Enotrans, and Nick Timrose covers economics and the presidential race for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks to both of you. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This is Radio Times. Thanks for listening.